history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that effort to give them their due, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Next weekend, of course, is Memorial Day weekend, when we honor the more than 1 million Americans who have given what President Lincoln famously described as their last full measure of devotion to our country. This weekend wraps up the not always as well publicized Armed Forces Week, highlighted by Armed Forces Day, marked annually on the third Saturday in May. It's a time set aside for us to honor all of those Americans currently serving in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Air Force, and this year, for the first time, we can include the Space Force as well. Just another reason for you to reach out this weekend and thank the people you know who are currently in uniform. On this program, we hear primarily, of course, from those who wore the uniform long, long ago. Continuing our recent theme of 75th anniversaries during these days where COVID-19 makes connecting in person with World War II veterans difficult, we're going to hear today about some things that were happening on and around the island of Okinawa 75 years ago this week. The battle had been raging there for 6 weeks already. Kamikaze attacks were plentiful. The fighting on land had intensified. Thousands of Americans had already been killed. Glenn Bram was a 19-year-old in the 2nd Marine Division. He had joined the Marines at 17, had already survived close calls in 3 major battles, and he wasn't sure how much longer this war would last. We're going to hear about what he experienced on May 14, 1945, but we'll start with his arrival at Okinawa.
We knew we were getting closer to Japan, but we thought we were going to have to go into Japan to finish it off. Mm-hmm. Remember, we landed there on Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day. It was, April the 1st. I was on there a month and a half before I finally got hit. I think I got hit May the 14th.
Wow. That is a long time. So what were you doing for that month and a half?
Gone, moving up in battles. One day you'd run into trouble, then you'd go 3 or 4 days and nothing would happen. Then you'd move up a little further and run into some more opposition.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with, or maybe the most terrifying part of the whole experience for you?
Well, it was all terrifying. Remember, they wanted, just 3 days before I got shot, they wanted to send me home to go to officer's candidate school. They said they'd ship me out right now. And I says, no, after this was over, I'd be coming home anyway, because after 4 campaigns, they automatically sent you home. And then, so 3 days later, then I got shot.
Tell me what happened. Your rifle jammed?
Yeah.
Where was the situation? Where were you and what was going on?
They had sent 2 squads of us in. There was some of the guys, another outfit, were trapped in this little valley. And they sent us in. And we could see them getting picked off down there. So I said, boy, no way are we going to, I won't take my squad down. It was just then, it says, Pluto, get ready. You're going down there. So you have to do it. So they sent a tank in with us. So we were behind the tank going up this little valley, and a mortar shell came in and hit right on the turret of the tank and put that out of commission. So I was right behind it. And when my rifle jammed, I bent over to fix it, and just then it felt like somebody hit me with their fist in the shoulder. And I lay in blood blowing all over, so I knew what happened. So about that time, everybody was getting hit. In fact, the other squad leader got hit with the same bullet that I got hit with. When it exploded, a chunk of it broke his arm.
Wow.
And right after that, we had this one platoon sergeant that was with us. He sent me a picture of himself after he got home. He got hit right through the mouth. It looked like a dimple on each side. It didn't hit a tooth or his tongue or anything.
Wow, what are the odds of that?
And that all happened just within a few minutes, and finally they sent smoke shells in and told us to go back. So you couldn't see anything from here to you, always getting out of that smoke. So we headed back, and I jumped in a shell hole because I got grazed in the arm, but just out of the smoke, a bullet hit me in the arm, and it hit my cartridge belt. And then I dove in the shell hole, and I dove in on my right side because this one was hurt, and I broke two ribs. Oh. I didn't know till afterwards, but I broke two ribs, and there were two guys in the hole, and they were two of the ones that we had gone in to try to get out, and they poured sulfa in my shoulder and everything and helped me get up to the top of the ridge, and then they took me back to the medical center then. But by that time, I had lost a lot of blood. I don't know how many pints of blood they gave me.
Yeah.
But I was still able to walk.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I want to underscore for people because they might be saying, well, wait a second. You said if his rifle hadn't jammed, he wouldn't be here. Well, the implication is if you're not bending over to fix that rifle, you're standing up and the shell hits you where?
It would right in the back or the shoulder. I mean, it's...
It would have just blown you
in half. Oh, yeah. Because I still get pieces that work out, like little pimples coming. I've got, I don't know how many pieces still in my neck.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. But it would have killed you. There's no question.
Oh, yeah,
you
wouldn't
be here.
Oh, that's right.
So it's a good thing that rifle jammed. But then, so now your shoulder's blown to bits. You dive in the hole. You crack two ribs. You can still walk, but you've lost all this blood. I mean, you've got to be just out of your mind. I can't imagine what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I was just happy to get back to the aid station anyway, and then they worked on me. I can remember the doctor asking me if I wanted to save some of those pieces coming out. I could hear him as he was dropping them in a can. I said, no, I don't want them. I did say, is this going to be enough to get me home? He said, it will. Don't worry about it.
Wow. How long of a process was that for you to recover?
Well, I was, I got hit May the 14th. I got home June the 14th. I'd been in the hospital in Guam for a week and then in Pearl Harbor for another couple of weeks. And then I was in the hospital at Pleasanton for a couple of weeks afterwards. But after that, I was able to take care of it myself. But it was such a hole, they couldn't stitch it. They had to use clamps to clamp it together because the stitches kept popping. So it left a pretty good hole.
And I imagine your parents found out when you got hit. They probably got a telegram or something?
They didn't. I wrote and told them that I'd gotten hit and I was coming home, so don't worry about me. They didn't. I was home on a furlough when they got the information that I had gotten hit.
There's got to be some kind of lasting impact of an injury that severe that basically blows off the top of your left shoulder.
Well, I can't raise my arm too high. I mean, that.
Yeah.
When I got discharged, they said, do you want to stay around for a medical discharge? And I said, how long will that take? Well, they don't know. I said, if I can get out now, I'll take it. I'll go now. So they did. They gave me a 20% disability, and I got that for about 2 years, and they called me up and said for another examination to see what it was, and they found out that I should have been getting 40% disability. So they gave me that. It was retroactive, which didn't amount to too much, but it was still quite a bit. So I've been getting that ever since. But I think if I would have stuck around for a medical discharge, I probably could have gotten 50%.
And as far as the way it is today, or for all these years, have you had pain, or it's just kind of limited mobility?
Just limited, but
yeah.
It bothers my golf swing. I don't have any backswing at all. They tied the tendons too tight, so that's why I can't raise my arm too high.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't bother me that bad.
So you were already home when Japan surrendered.
Yeah, I was home on a furlough.
What was that like for you after every... I mean, you've been at some pretty significant battles against these guys.
Well, I remember my cousin and I went deer hunting. As soon as it was over, we took off, went up to the ranch deer hunting for the weekend. Everybody was celebrating in town, and we went off by ourselves deer hunting.
How much have you told your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids about this over the years?
Very little. I mean, I never... Once in a while, they'll ask me questions, and I'll tell them something, but I just never cared to even talk about it, really.
You're glad to get home and didn't need to live in the past.
That's
huh?
Right, yeah. I worked for the Gilroy Lumber Company about 25 years. I retired when I was 55. I had a stroke. Some friends and I were fishing in Idaho, and I had a stroke there. I was in intensive care for a few days, and finally my wife and one of my sons came up, and a son-in-law took a motor home and picked me up and brought me home. But they wondered what caused the stroke. They gave me all kinds of tests when I got home. Just about 2 weeks before I left to go fishing, the doctor cut a piece of shrapnel out of my neck. And when he was cutting, I could feel it clicking in there on my windpipe. I says, that clicking my wind? No, he says, don't worry about it. He says, there's a lot of things more important than that. He says, it's right on the carotid artery. And I think that's what happened when a chunk of something got in that carotid artery afterwards.
Sure.
That's what caused it.
And you still have pieces of that shrapnel in there.
Yeah.
About how often does one of them work its way to the surface?
Oh, every 6 or 8 months a piece will come out. In fact, my wife pulled one out some years ago. It was just like a little fish hook. And she pulled it out, and it had about an inch piece of my jacket still hanging on the piece of shrapnel.
Your jacket had been under your skin for all those years?
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. When you think back on that time, and obviously this is a lot of nights spent in foxholes, a lot of days in combat, a lot of close calls, that closest call we just heard about. But what are the things that today maybe you still think about and say, you know, somebody was really looking out for me there, or I'm really proud of how I handled that there?
Well, it's a sense somebody was looking out for me, that's for sure. As far as handling things, the one thing that started me off right when I first went overseas, we went to Wellington, New Zealand, for replacements for the 2nd Division after Guadalcanal. So some of the guys that were on Guadalcanal were with us. We were getting ready to go to Tarawa, and this one sergeant told me, he says, when you land, make sure you don't go out. When they drop the ramp down, don't go out, go over the side of the boat. He says, if they have a machine gun trained on that ramp, it'll get everybody. So he says, go over the side. Mm. Well, I did. I didn't know how deep the water was, and I couldn't swim. But anyway, it was only up over my chest a little bit. But I remember that's something that probably helped me, just what he told me there.
Sure. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the question I was going to ask you that I forgot. With not being able to swim,
yeah,
was there ever a point during your time in the service where you thought that was going to be your undoing, where you found yourself in a situation?
I thought that might have been, but I was lucky enough. We were in close enough. In fact, I came in under a pier right afterwards. There was a little pier there, and I came in under that. But there some of the ones behind me, they just drowned right there.
Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of with regard to your time in the Marine Corps?
I'm just proud to be a Marine, I guess. That's for sure. I mean, it was a good outfit.
Do you have some pride based on what collectively 16 million Americans in the armed forces and all the people back at home supporting them, what you were able to accomplish?
What bothers me are the ones that came back from Vietnam and Korea with the treatment they got. I didn't think that was right. I mean, we didn't get treated that way when we got home. We got treated as heroes, which the heroes are the dead ones, really.
And there were a lot of those at those battles that you were in and throughout the war, 406,000 of them.
Yeah.
When you think of that number, that more than 400,000 Americans died, and you know how close you came to adding to that, what does that mean to you? What do you think of when you consider that?
Well, when you think about the Civil War, it's nothing. Look what they did.
That's true.
But if we hadn't have... A lot of people thought the atomic bomb was terrible. It was bad, but we would have lost a lot more if we would have had to go into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That saved a lot of lives on both sides.
That's a sentiment you've heard shared by many a World War II veteran here on Hometown Heroes over the years, including another Purple Heart recipient named Alan George. The same day Glenn Brehm was wounded on Okinawa, George was wounded aboard the aircraft carrier USS Bataan just off the coast of Okinawa.
We had the 4 or 5 inch shells come on the port side of our ship. Believe it or not, that was from American ships that were tracking on a kamikaze plane, and they got down so low and they still tracked on the plane and fired 4 or 5 inch shells, and those are what hit our ship.
Well, and this was the incident that left you wounded and with this piece of shrapnel. In fact, I saw your Purple Heart box on the table. I could tell that was the box your Purple Heart came in. I expected to see the Purple Heart inside, but you've got a little piece of shrapnel in there. Tell me what you remember about. That was, what, May 14th of 45?
Yes. All I can remember is that if I hadn't been down on the deck, I wouldn't be here today, Paul. And that was my lucky day. And I guess one of the saddest things out of that incident and some of the other ones that we experienced was a burial at sea. They put the deceased in a coffin, and then they weighed it down with a shell, so it'll, and then they have a little deal on the side of the ship where it's kind of a trough type of deal where they can take the coffin and they slide it into the sea, and then they play taps. And if you haven't experienced that, I'm glad you haven't, because it's very, very sad to think you've lost a shipmate, and that's what they have to do, is bury him out at sea.
Well, and as you say that, I think back to that quote that I read from the Visalia Times Delta back in 1945 and relaying the information to your hometown about the fact that you were wounded. And you were quoted in that article, "Lots of mothers may have the medal, but not the son it represents. I know of quite a few that will never return, and I shall never forget the day after we were hit and they had the burial at sea." So it was etched in your mind that day, and I think I hear between the words that you're saying a sentiment that not only your heart goes out to those who lost loved ones, but that it was real easy to picture yourself in one of those coffins being buried at sea.
That's right. I guess the good Lord was looking over my shoulder at that time, or I wouldn't have been flat on the deck. Then the other thing that comes to my mind is that a lot of us wouldn't be here today if they hadn't dropped the atomic bomb in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, because after we spent a month in the Philippine Islands for R&R, then we were preparing our ships for the invasion of Japan.
I don't want you to get away without telling us the whole story of May 14th. We want to hear what happened so we can see through our eyes and our imagination what you experienced that day. You talked about hitting the deck. You're in this radio shack, right?
Yes, I can remember getting hit, and it wasn't very long that some of my compatriots came in and picked me up and carried me out of there and took me down to sick bay, because I was bleeding some, and hospital corpsmen and the surgeons that we had on our ship were wonderful, and I had that shrapnel dug out either that day or the next day, I don't remember now, but it didn't take very long, and I was back on duty in a couple days. So it just shows you how those people are trained to take care of those of us that have the misfortune of being wounded.
So you're talking about these 5-inch shells coming through the port side of your ship. Did you hear something, feel something? What prompted you to hit the deck, as you say?
Well, we'd been at battle stations for a long time, and we were all very tired, so I won't admit it, but I may have been sleeping. But that's okay. I mean, at general quarters, because we were at general quarters for a long time, and you get kind of tired and worn out, and pressure, of course, takes hold. And I guess it was the next day, and here was a destroyer going alongside our ship, smoothing out the water so we wouldn't take any more water in the ship, because at the elevation that the shell came in the ship, it was right at the water line, so they had to take that precaution to keep the water from coming into the ship. So after I looked at that hole in there, and I really counted my blessings, because that was a great big huge hole, and to think that I was flat on the deck and only wound up with some shrapnel, I guess the good Lord was looking after me.
No doubt, and I hear you saying that you might feel a little embarrassed if you were indeed sleeping, if you had just given into sheer exhaustion and passed out there, but I also hear you saying that if that's what happened, it probably saved your life, that if you were sitting somewhere or upright, that it may have cost you your life?
That's right, yeah. We had one officer that just came aboard ship. I don't know, he must have had some kind of an inkling that shell was coming, because he was out of the radio shack before the shell even hit. So he survived that too. But I guess there was only a couple of us in the radio shack at the time that shell hit us. Nobody was killed in there, and I was the only one wounded.
Where were you hit on your body, and what did it feel like?
Well, I was hit in my chest and my leg and my arm. I still have a little bit of a scar, some scars left, but not very much.
When you open up that box now and you see that little rusted hunk of iron, what does it represent to you? What does it make you think of?
It makes me think of how lucky I am. But, I was very privileged to get the Purple Heart. A lot of people that got the Purple Heart didn't become part of the Greatest Generation. They just didn't survive. Anyway, Very lucky.
If you'd like to listen to the complete original interviews with those two Purple Heart veterans wounded on the same day 75 years ago this week, you can find those links at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a remarkable story from another carrier off the coast of Okinawa 75 years ago, a story that took almost that many years to come full circle. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.